Well, I'm going to give you a progress report on something that we've started 10 years ago. Actually, it started in 1995, but it started getting funding in 1997 from the National Endowment for the Humanities. The original goals of the Stanford Encyclopedia of Philosophy were to organize the profession of philosophy to collaboratively write, edit, and maintain an up-to-date reference work that's responsive to new research. We had this idea in 1995 that it no longer makes sense to publish a reference work in print, because even by the time all the articles are in and they start to be typeset, they go out of date. So we figured we might as well start building the tools that are necessary to have a revisable reference work and a rational means of keeping that reference work up to date and responsive to new research. So our target audience originally was philosophy students and colleagues, but it turns out that we've reached a much wider audience than that. The mission of our authors is to introduce students and colleagues that don't have any special knowledge of a topic to the main issues and the most important pieces of literature, so as to bring them to a state where they can read the primary and secondary literature with insight and understanding. So right now, we've grown to an editorial board of 106 professional philosophers. They're the ones that commission entries, and referee updates. And they're appointed by a consultation with our advisory board, which is the Stanford Philosophy Department. Everyone that gets onto the editorial board has to be approved by the Stanford Philosophy Department. And they've chosen, now we've got 1,186 authors spread out at universities around the world. Each of them is maintaining one particular entry of their expertise, and they're reporting back to the profession and updating those entries on a regular basis. We've got 911 entries published, and they're substantive pieces of work. They're over 10,000 words in average length. And we've got another 400 or so commissioned. But of course, none of those numbers are fixed. Sometimes we're adding new subject areas to the encyclopedia. We're creating new, commissioning new entries. Sometimes old topics are decommissioned. And things are always in a state of flux. There's just no final endpoint. Research always continues, and it's just a process, not a product that we're after. So our process is basically our publishing model. And basically what happens is we've defined all the states that an entry could possibly be in. And I won't put up our workflow diagram, but basically an entry can be in a state where it has to be, a subject editor has to invite someone, or someone has to accept the invitation, or someone has accepted the invitation and they've got to write the piece, or the piece is written and the subject editor has to review it. And for each state, there's a deadline and someone who owes work by that deadline. And we've built software with the help of the National Science Foundation to manage that whole process as much automatically as possible. And so that the people, the editorial staff, the main paid editorial staff, only has to get involved when things break down. And of course, also they also are involved in the copy editing and formatting to HTML stage. But there's, in fact, a lot of editorial decisions that also have to be taken, especially if there's conflict between the subject editors and the authors, or someone, a member of the public, writes in and says that this is not a fair evaluation of a particular topic. So that's where part of the editorial work goes. The authors typically send us HTML from either Word or LaTeX. They basically save as HTML, or they use some LaTeX program and generate HTML, and then we have to clean it up. And this is also a large part of our effort, because as you probably know, the HTML that's generated by Word is probably the worst on the planet. And so we've built programs to help strip out as much of the junk as we possibly can from the Word files. Fortunately, Word puts it in a systematic way, so you can strip it out in a systematic way, but you still have several hours of work by hand to produce valid and compliant XHTML. And then we built password-protected web interfaces for our authors. Our authors can, from anywhere in the world, sit down at a network computer and log in to the Stanford Encyclopedia server and fix typos, correct errors in their entries, and submit those for review. And our subject editors, when they get articles that have been submitted for update or for review, they can click a button and compare the original version with the revised version side by side in their web browsers with the differences highlighted. So for example, they might see something like this show up on their web browser. Oh, yes. So suppose I got Frege's nationality wrong. I go in, I've given a talk in Austria, and they've corrected me. I've gone in and made a change from German to Austrian and click submit, and then it goes to a subject editor who hits a button, and it shows up that I've changed the word German to Austrian. So that's the kind of thing that subject editors do. Of course, they make decisions on a much more substantive nature, but that's just a typical example. Every new entry and every revision to an entry, therefore, is carefully refereed and approved before publication. So this is not a Wikipedia model. And for scholarly citation purposes, we build archives. We take a snapshot of the encyclopedia 4 times a year and archive it in a fixed section of the encyclopedia that doesn't ever get changed. So that's basically our publishing model. And as a result of that publishing model, we've had some unexpected results. We're getting accessed up to 700,000 times a week, and that's all handled by a single server, though we have mirror sites around the world that sync with that main server every 24 hours. We've discovered that our entries are showing up in hundreds of course syllabi, not only in the philosophy department courses, but in other courses as well. That entries are widely read by students and scholars in other disciplines. So for example, you can see that a lot of the entries are read by, mathematics or computer science or natural sciences, and that there's a large group of people in history and the humanities. And this was all information taken about 5 years ago, and I suspect it hasn't changed too much. But also, across the university spectrum, we thought that only philosophers were going to be looking at this, but if we went to our access statistics server and found the following subdomains at one large campus, all of which had computers, which had accessed the Stanford Encyclopedia of Philosophy. So it's being read across the campus, and this is replicated campus after campus, and we actually have a mechanism for you to determine for your campus which subdomains are actually accessing the encyclopedia. We've also discovered that despite the popularity of Wikipedia, some of our articles, you know, still come up as the top hit on Google. Now, you'd expect the Wikipedia articles to be more popular than ours because they're written to a popular style. They're not often not technical, although some are. But the more the more arcane the subject, the worse the Wikipedia article tends to be. And so, for example, if you go, and this is a live link, and I just did a search. Oh, I forgot. I have to log in here. I see. Let's see if I can get in here. Let's see if it will let me now. I guess I lost my access when I closed my computer down. Okay, let's try it now. So this is a live link. There we go. So voluntary euthanasia is now the first thing you get when you search on Google. The same goes for the philosopher Gottlob Frege. The same goes for if you click on search for animal consciousness, you get the entry on animal consciousness, and this is our server. Just to show you, you can go there. That's a live link. And feminist ethics. So you get the idea. It's something that's unexpected for us to see that articles written by philosophers who trained in a certain way actually are being widely read by members of the public. And some of our entries find unexpected readers. Paraconsistent logic is the logic you get into when you have a contradiction, and we discovered computers at the Vatican were looking at this entry. We wondered what theological contradiction they got into that caused them to look at this. And the entry on holes, which is philosophically interesting, holes have dimensions but they have no mass, was actually the focus of a lot of attention. In fact, a CNN reporter interviewed the author back in 2000 because at the end of in December 2000, a Florida election official waved a ballot and said, "I don't know what a hole is. Go ask an expert." And so basically the fate of the United States turned on the definition of what's a hole. And this is what philosophers think about. So anyway, it's a very rewarding result. So now, what about our funding model? Now you've seen our publishing model and some of its successes. We've had a history of grants starting back in 1997. We were awarded a grant from the NEH, which lasted from 98 to 2000. We got a large award from the NSF, the Digital Libraries Initiative. We have a small grant from Mellon, and then continuing support from the NEH and a grant from the Hewlett Foundation to help us do some fundraising, about which I'll mention in just a minute. In total, we've spent $1.3 million, and if you add the startup money that Stanford's contributed of $200,000 or more, then we've got a total of $1.5 million in building this project from 1995. And you should compare that with, for example, the Open Courseware project at MIT, which is a wonderful project, but they're spending close to $30 million over the course of 10 years, and we're getting about one-third the accesses that they're getting. The projects are somewhat similar. They have 900 people within one university contributing content to their website, whereas we have about 900 to 1,000 people spread out all over the world at different universities, but within one profession contributing content. And they get about 2 million accesses a week on their servers, and we get about 700,000. And so that's a pretty fair return for the investment that we've built so far. So now, how are we funding this for the long term? Well, our budget, now this is not a journal. This is not something where you just publish a few articles per week. This is an ongoing process. It involves lots of people. It's managed all at a central office with 1.7 persons, two people working at 75% time and two people working at 10% time. And those people have to have some various kinds of talents. They have to know about Unix operating systems so they can bring the server online. They have to know about Perl so they can create Perl programs to do back-end processing. They need to know how to install web servers. They need to know, they need to be philosophers so they can edit the journals and think the entries when they come online. So our budget is $200,000 a year to maintain and keep this whole thing going strong. The Stanford, and our idea for this was to raise a $4.125 million endowment, but it's a special kind of endowment. It's protected in a way that I'm going to describe in just a second. And so the idea was that Stanford would raise $1.125 million from private donors, and the worldwide library community would raise $3 million, and this thing would then carry on open access like it has been since 1995. And the interesting part of this model is that the money that the libraries contribute to this project by paying membership dues to our support organization, it gets transferred to Stanford under a contract that's vetted by the National Endowment for the Humanities. And under that contract, Stanford deposits the money in its endowment in a special escrow account, manages the money for free, or its normal cost, it doesn't add any additional fees, and Stanford has agreed to return the money to the libraries should the project ever be terminated. Okay, so basically it's an investment because last year it made 19% on its investment, but typically it won't take all that money. It has a smoothing process. So you can figure an average of 8 to 10% on Stanford's return. It pays out 5% to the project. So the library money is sitting in there earning about 3.5% per year minimum, assuming Stanford does normally. And so Stanford will then, and also if the project is ever moved to another university, Stanford's agreed to let the library money that's been collected follow the project. Moreover, the libraries that join our support organization, they get other perks. They get one-click archive downloads. They get branding, little banners that say thank you to the relevant library unit. And they get representation on a governing board, which we're in the process of forming. So that funding model has got certain measures of success. The National Endowment for the Humanities has endorsed this model by offering us a $500,000 challenge grant. And so if we raise $1.5 million from the libraries, they will give us $500,000 for free. Stanford has already raised its share from private donations of $1.125 million. We've had some wonderful successes. The entire country, the UK system, through its GIST committee, did a survey of 77 philosophers and librarians, and they unanimously endorsed the encyclopedia, and they did a national level deal, and we came to an arrangement where the UK would pay the encyclopedia $250,000, a one-time, or they spread it over several years, but that's the entire contribution, all the libraries and institutions in the UK, higher education institutions are part of this deal. The UC system, all 10 campuses, even though two of them don't have philosophy departments, voted for this arrangement. And we're only asking for them to contribute for the institutions that offer PhDs and masters and bachelors. But in the UC case, it's only PhD institutions. And so they basically gave us 8 times $15,000 for the 8 campuses that offer PhDs. And I'm pleased to report today that libraries worldwide have now pledged $1,650,000 in membership dues to CEPIA. We've collected about 2/3 of that. And if you add in the $500,000 from the National Endowment for the Libraries, from the National Endowment for the Humanities, the libraries only need $850,000 more to reach their goal. Now, the place where we're looking to make that final $850,000 is that we've discovered that 44 of 118 institutions that offer a PhD in philosophy in the United States and Canada haven't pledged anything. And if each of those were to pledge the recommended amount of $15,000, we'd have $660,000, which is 3/4 of the remainder needed. And if some of the under-contributing institutions, in fact, if all the under-contributing institutions were to complete their commitment and register for the full amount, we'd make our full $850,000 with about $20,000 to spare. So let me conclude with a series of slides on observations. What does our model offer? Well, our funding model and our publishing model offers the broadest possible access to published research because it's all open access. And because of the innovations in publishing scholarly reference work that we've implemented, it reduces the distribution costs and speeds the delivery and extends the availability of reference works. It gives quality assurance through peer review. As I mentioned, everything that goes into web space is reviewed by somebody before it goes online, an expert or a subject editor or an external referee. It gives scholars control. This whole enterprise has been implemented by scholars with PhDs in philosophy. In fact, every line of Perl code has been written by someone either with a PhD in philosophy, a logician, or someone who was a graduate student in philosophy who switched to computer science, but we still count him as a philosopher. So it's really controlled by the scholars and the academy and the library community over publishing, and it strengthens scholarly communication and the ties between the scholarly community and the library community. Our model offers libraries a means to help bring about changes in scholarly publishing because this can serve as an example for other professions. The libraries pay a fair and reasonable cost for receiving the benefits of membership. We've asked PhD institutions in the US and Canada to pay a one-time fee of $15,000 and never contribute anything again as far as membership dues, and they can spread that out over 3 years. If you offer masters, we've asked for $6,000. If you offer a BA in philosophy, we've asked for $3,000. And it's prorated for countries in other parts of the world. And this also gives libraries a method to address their library budget crisis through a one-time payment system and through money which is being protected instead of disappearing on a yearly basis. It's going into an account. It's earning interest. And it's just not disappearing. It's serving, it's being put to work to fund open access. And I can't emphasize enough how important this kind of model should serve as for others who want to see some differences going about in their kinds of models. And also, on our model, there's fair use of copyrighted information because the authors retain copyright to their work, but they give us an exclusive license to publish it on the web. And finally, there's preservation of scholarly information for the long term because not only do we have backup servers, but we have mirror sites. They keep copies of all our data, and our mirror sites have backup systems. So if the big earthquake hits California, Stanford slides into the sea, all of our data is protected in Sydney. If Sydney is consumed by wildfires, all of our data is protected in the Netherlands. If the dikes break through global warming and the swamp in Amsterdam, well, we still have a copy of our data in Leeds. And then there's all those libraries who've contributed money through membership dues who have downloaded copies of our archives, and they're distributed throughout all the world. So that's pretty good preservation, we think. The second set of assumptions is, will this model generalize? We think it will. The resources must be well established. So in particular, if you've got a publishing system that's well established, has a good reputation, a high academic standards, and you've got a measurable impact as a result of years of publicly funded open access or years of high quality content funded by ongoing annual subscriptions, you might be able to use this kind of model. What you need to do is you need to get the interest of large library or umbrella organizations. And we were able to enlist the support of iColc, of Spark, of Solanet, and other people who have joined this cause to help us get top-down access to librarians, to help convince them that this is a good model that's worthy of their participation. And those large umbrella library organizations, you have to open up your budgets to them so that they can vet those budgets and make sure that they're reasonable. And then your resource has to have a sizable volunteer workforce of authors and editors, because then they can lobby their librarians from the bottom up. So you got to kind of put the librarians in a little squeeze play. I don't mean to treat you as objects here, but really, that's our strategy, to try to reach the librarians and convince them of the efficacy of this model from the top down and from the bottom up. And your resource must be located at a well-established university with a rock-solid history of managing its endowment, and you must have administrators there, like a provost, like we have at Stanford, with some foresight who are willing to enter into innovative institutional arrangements. When I first proposed this to the Stanford provost, he said, no way. There's no way we're going to let the libraries think of Stanford as an investment house. But then I explained to him, and I said, John, look, there's no way you're going to get small colleges and large public institutions to contribute money to a place like Stanford, which is a rich private institution, without giving them some sort of guarantees. Because otherwise, they're going to worry that Stanford will just shut the project down, keep the money, and go on its merry way and do some other things. He finally saw the point. He then started signing contracts saying that Stanford would give the money back if the project's ever terminated. This was, in fact, a requirement for the NEH Challenge Grant. And finally, this model will generalize if the fundraising goals are seen by everyone as moderate and attainable, they serve the public interest, and the interest the public and private funding institutions to help support the plan. The final set of observations might be of interest, and that's the problems that we've encountered. Well, one thing is you can't get foundation support for this kind of model. Foundations don't like to contribute to endowments. They don't like seeing money go from their endowment to another endowment. But they will give you money to support operations, they will give you money to fundraise, and that's what the Hewlett Grant, the Hewlett Foundation has given us $200,000 to help us carry out our fundraising plan. Some librarians, which is a problem, some libraries at institutions that significantly use the encyclopedia still remain free riders. Some of them, I hate to say, are sitting back waiting for others to see whether the thing will get funded, and then they will get away without having to pay anything. And some of them reason, well, look, why should I pay for something that everybody else can get for free? Well, this is one of those situations where we try to explain that unless the libraries all hang together, they'll all hang separately, in the words of a famous American patriot. So this is where you really need to work together as a community to help to fund these kinds of new models. And I hope I've made the case for that clear. We had some means of helping to persuade these free riders. We used to put little encouragement banners instead of branding banners for those outlying institutions that told their users that this library wasn't contributing. But as a gesture of good faith in response to the library community, we've now tone those way down, and you have to do some work to figure out that your library is not actually a contributor. But in fact, if we don't reach our goals, those might have to come back. But I'm hoping that that won't happen. And finally, another problem that we're having is that some librarians say, this one threw me when I first heard this, that we're forcing them to operate outside their mission, that they now have to assess business models and become venture capitalists. And, that's true in some sense, but this is precisely the reasons that libraries are organizing into consortia and building coalitions with other libraries and developing things like the ACRL committees and things of this kind. The libraries need to trust that the people that they're aligned with and their consortia will have people who can vet our business models, which have our budgets and our business plan. And this was taking place with Spark and with iCulc and with Solonet. They've all looked at this carefully, and because of that, they've endorsed this project. So that's the only thing I can say in response to try to convince librarians that, well, look, you know, try, if you don't have the means to do this, then go up one level to the consortia with which you're aligned. And that's really the last thing I had to say, but I wanted to raise in conclusion one final delicate point, and that has to do with the mistake that I think we made in assigning payment schedules for institutions in Canada. There's a lower rate for Australia, New Zealand, and the UK, but the institutions in Canada, Tom Sandville, the head of iCulc, who set these prices, decided that they were a member of the North American community and that PhD institutions in Canada should pay the same rate as PhD institutions in the US, and MA, same for MA and bachelor institutions. And in retrospect, that probably was a mistake, because as it turns out, although we have over half of the PhD institutions in the US fully contributing $15,000, we have only a quarter of the PhD institutions in Canada contributing $15,000. Five of the 21 institutions, and I'm happy to name the University of Toronto, University of Alberta, the University of Calgary, York University, and Dalhousie University as the five Canadian institutions offering a PhD in philosophy that have made a full contribution. So if anybody knows how I can go about rectifying this so that we can come to some arrangement so that maybe not everybody pays the full amount, but we get some sort of a important and significant percentage from Canadian institutions, I'd be happy to talk with you and try to sort this out, because that's the only other thing that we can do to complete this fundraising mission. And with that, I'll stop and say thank you.